We could do the whole thing like a musical, you know. What is the greatest challenge that faces us all today? I
Was that second voice supposed to be me?
Maybe it's
She's the number one reason why you want to move to the Maritimes. This is Sanjana Needs a Friend.
Welcome back to the podcast, everyone.
Hey-o.
This is our final episode.
Part one of the final episode.
Yeah, part one of the final episode. Part one of the finale.
Yes.
Mini-series finale of Sanjana Needs a Friend. I think I have friends.
Yes. Now. Finally.
Yeah. If nothing else, we'll have to stop doing this podcast because the name is no longer relevant. I no longer need a friend. I have many.
Yeah, I mean, if things clear up, maybe the next podcast needs to be Sanjana and Dave Hit the Road.
Oh,
our cross-country check-ins.
Amazing.
How great would that be?
That would be awesome, actually. We'd be very happy to do a cross-country podcast road trip. Bring the kids.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Get a big camper van.
Oh, yeah. Deck out a Westphalia. That'd probably be a bit too small for the four of you, actually. Five of you.
Six. You're coming along.
In the van?
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's
I'll
just
drive
find
behind
someone
you in the Civic.
Fund this thing.
Thanks. So, Dave, it's that time in Vancouver when it starts to be summer, even though the rest of Canada is stuck in this perpetual thaw freeze cycle that is unpredictable.
Yes.
And horrible. Except in Halifax, we're in an unpredictable and horrible rain cycle.
But you probably get to eat storm chips.
Yeah, on occasion. Actually, I recently tried, speaking of chips, magic masala chips. Have you
I really thought you were going to say magic mushroom chips. It's like, okay.
I'm not
you've been hanging out with Ian Elliott too much.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah, no, magic masala. So there's like, it's a flavor in India, but they made like a Canadian version of it. So it's like made in Canada, magic masala. And they also have a cream and onion. So not sour cream and onion. So it's a little bit sweeter than sour cream and onion.
Ooh.
Also an Indian flavor.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. They're pretty good.
Who makes it?
Lay's.
Lay's. Okay.
Mm-hmm. They are ruffle cut, which I don't know if you have opinions on potato chip cuts, but ruffle is my least favorite.
Ruffle's the best for a dip, though.
Yeah, sure.
Sturdy for a dip.
It is. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I will take just a plain old thin cut kettle cooked chip.
Mm. I ate too many Miss Vicky's last night.
Mm-hmm.
So I woke up this morning with that, like, oh, my mouth. It's kind of burnt from the sea salt
and
malt vinegar.
Yeah, kind of cankery. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which flavor?
Snacking late at night. Sea salt malt vinegar.
Yes.
It's delicious, but it's just like the next day regrets.
Yeah.
The next day regrets.
I hear you. And it's tough because I love that Miss Vicky's uses malt vinegar in their salt and vinegar.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's the only salt and vinegar worth eating at this point. And that's like
only
my favorite
vinegar.
Flavor.
It's the only vinegar.
It's the only vinegar.
Well, there's balsamic vinegar, but that's a different game.
It's so niche.
I know.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, we were talking about summer in Vancouver.
Oh, yeah, it's cherry blossom madness here in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
So little known fact, the street that we live on has a cherry blossom canopy, which when we moved in here, nobody knew about. But thanks, no thanks. To Instagram and a stupid hashtag with my street name in it, we now get thousands of people visiting our street.
Gravelly.
Gravely. Gravely.
I know.
But no, I don't want to say the name for InterVarsity people. Keep them away. No.
Yeah.
Keep them at bay.
Alex Norrie is going to fly over from Ontario just to see the cherry blossoms on your street.
Well, I was actually hoping Sherry Mothy would come over. I mean, Sherry Gothy. You'll get that joke if you listen to earlier podcasts. Mm. Yeah, but our street's pretty crazy. We get tour bus. Tour buses come up. People are not wearing their masks. So it's like,
oh, no.
It's just not a fun scene out here.
I mean, I guess you can't wear a mask if you're doing it for the gram.
Nope. But here's what I say. Check out on Instagram, Cherry Blossom Madness. It's my neighbor across the street, and you will see some of the redonkulous things that happen here on Gravelly Street. But anyways, we should not talk about cherry blossoms. We should talk about more exciting things like El Presidente.
Also known as Nigel.
Yep.
Yeah.
Nigel.
That's how all of the Newfoundland students were saying it before they met him. They were so excited. Actually, they thought he was like English at first. So they were saying it very proper. Nigel. And then switched.
Where's the first place you met Nigel?
That's a great question. Okay, it was either a Nova Scotia fundraiser that he came to, or it was at a NAITS conference at Tyndale University.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
First time I saw him was at World Assembly 2015.
Mm.
And
was that the one in Mexico?
That was in Mexico. And yeah. He managed to make the most boring meeting about constitutional bylaw amendments for IFES actually entertaining. It was quite hilarious. And that's also the place where I first heard the words IFES.
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 Yeah.
Not IFES, but IFES.
Not from Nigel, I'm
not
sure.
Not from Nigel.
As we'll find out.
Yes, we'll find out. So, I mean, I asked that question because, you know, Nigel's a fun guy. And today's podcast is hilarious. So if you haven't gotten to know Nigel through our all staff calls, you're going to learn a little bit more about him.
You haven't been attending.
You haven't been attending them, yes.
yeah.
So
yeah,
my hope out of this is that ultimately, Sanjana, you would become friends with Nigel. So that's the goal for this podcast.
Yeah. That feels daunting, Dave, even now.
Well,
I don't think I've ever been friends with a president before of anything, anywhere.
Well, there's always today.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers.
Oh my gosh, okay, just send us over to this podcast already.
Okay, well, let's go make a friend.
Hi, I'm Nigel Pollock. I'm part of the leadership team at InterVarsity Canada. And I'm humbled and excited about being Sanjana's friend.
So when we were coming up with questions for this episode, we were trying to draw from all of the previous episodes that we've done. So we kind of wanted to ask similar questions to the questions that we've asked previous guests. And on our first episode, of course, we asked the question, what do you do? Which for some of our guests was a little bit easier to answer and for some was a little bit harder. But I think that's as good a place to start as any with Nigel Pollock, what do you do?
Well, I just like to point out that if at any point a previous answer is different from mine, the previous person's answer will be true. So just ignore what I say.
Okay.
I'm kind of responsible for leading the staff team and providing overall direction to the work of InterVarsity in Canada. And telling the story of who we are.
Is that similar to what you did in New Zealand or quite different?
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic tasks of leadership don't actually change that much from place to place, but you have to try to understand how things are different in different cultures. Hmm. So a lot of the headlines would be the same, but I've spent the last 2.5 years trying to understand InterVarsity, trying to understand Canadian culture, because people speak the same language doesn't mean you can make assumptions that it's the same as where you've come from. We used to see in New Zealand that people made assumptions who came from Australia. I think in Canada, you can see people making assumptions who come from the United States. And growing up in Scotland, I certainly saw assumptions from people who came from England. So I've spent my life in kind of little brother, little sister countries with a kind of a bigger brother or older sister who's knocked you about a bit and thought they understood you, but doesn't always feel like that at the time.
Interesting. I mean, it does seem like your previous experiences prepared you well in some ways for leading the movement in Canada, but were there blind spots that you ran into as you were getting to know this movement and this country?
Well, I think there are always blind spots, and it's why you have to listen and why you have to read and why you have to, you know, when you come across something, you need to say, what can I learn from this difference, rather than, oh, they do this wrong. So there are lots of different things. You know, I think the fact that I'd moved from Scotland to New Zealand gave me a greater understanding of some of the issues, but the fact that you've made that transition once doesn't inoculate you or vaccinate you against doing it a second time. You have to do the hard yards. Having lived in Canada for 6 months in 1998, I think was a helpful foundation, because it meant that we had spent a little bit of time here and knew one or two people from InterVarsity. And I came back to Canada and did things with InterVarsity once or twice a year, really through to the early 2000s. So I did a new staff orientation, did a mission at McGill, spoke at Thunder Bay and Winnipeg, and a fundraiser in Montreal. So there was a few different things that I'd done with InterVarsity, and I'd also met some InterVarsity people through the international fellowship that I've been pretty involved with for the last 25 years. But there, you know, it's still hard work trying to understand a new context and to work out why people do things the way that they do.
Where were you in 98?
I had a Winston Churchill Fellowship looking at different voluntary agencies and the way they train and develop their volunteers. So we were mostly in British Columbia, but did a little bit in the Pacific Northwest of the US. But as part of that, we stayed at Pioneer Pacific for 6 weeks, because Neil Graham, who was the Western director at the time, I got to know through IFES, and he arranged for us to have some accommodation there. So that was really the entry point to beginning to meet some InterVarsity people, because Neil introduced me to Jim Burnley, who was the president at the time, and to one or two other staff. Hmm. So Jim invited me to go and speak to the senior leadership team, and there I met Larry Offner and Ruth Lewis, and they've been kind of friends ever since.
That's pretty neat.
I mean, so one of the questions I would have that's kind of related to this is, so it sounds like you have a certain posture that you've taken coming into the position. Are there, which is like openness and needing to learn and not assuming because you've done it before in a different context, you're going to get it right here. Is there anything that you've been really surprised by in your role here, that you didn't know that this was going to be a dynamic of being the president in Canada, or this was going to be a new responsibility that came with the territory?
Yeah, I mean, I was I was surprised to discover the level of financial difficulty that the movement had got into. I was surprised by some of the things that became quite clear to me about the culture of the organization. I think on a wider kind of setup, one of the things that I'd become quite aware of in New Zealand was the relationship with the indigenous people there, the Maori. And it was interesting to me in Canada that there wasn't the same dynamics of relationship with Indigenous people and Indigenous issues. So at the Urbana that I went to after a few months, I hosted an event to invite Indigenous students and staff who were interested from Canada to come and talk about their experiences. I asked Tina, who's an Indigenous artist who was working at one of the camps, to design my Christmas card the first year. And we've tried to bring in land acknowledgements and one or two other things as part of the journey in Canada. But I think that's a journey that Canada is on, that InterVarsity is trying to look at how we participate in that. I think it'd be fair to say that issues of race and justice, while some of the underlying principles are the same throughout the world, they do play out differently in different geographical jurisdictions because of the particular history in different places.
Do those differences in I guess, like, culture and history that you're talking about, do you find that that plays out as well in more generally the way that people interact with each other? So you talked about, like, settler and Indigenous relationships, but what about just sort of the way that people relate to each other in society at large? Have you found that to be quite different between, say, New Zealand and Scotland and Canada?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still at an early stage of understanding Canada. So I'm sure. I'm not quite at the point of making pronouncements. One of the things that I determined when I went to New Zealand was that I wasn't really going to say very much publicly for the first year or so, that I was going to try and listen and understand. Mm. And I think it's always important that we do that. We're often a little bit missiologically lazy in the Western Church. That, you know, if we were to go to, you know, if we were to go to Japan to do mission work, we would understand, we'd have to spend the first block of time learning the language and understanding the culture and how people relate. But we've got a tendency just to kind of blast in and think we know what we're doing, because they say that similar cultures fool you more into a sense of complacency. And I think there are quite significant differences between some of those places we spoke about earlier on, you know, between the US and Canada, between Australia and New Zealand, between Scotland and England and Ireland and Wales. And a lot of it is about not asserting that the way that I have learned to do something somewhere else is the way that you must do it here.
Yeah. Do you have examples of that?
I'm sure I do. In there, you know, one of the differences between New Zealand and the United States is that New Zealand is very much a value-earned culture. So what counts in New Zealand is what they call the hard yards, what you do in New Zealand. You earn your reputation through what you do. Whereas America is a value assumed culture, you know, that you have your reputation and that gives you a start. So in New Zealand, in leadership, you're kind of, you're guilty until proven innocent. Whereas in America, you're kind of innocent until proven guilty. Right. So one of the things that people who came to work in New Zealand from the United States struggled with was, why don't people trust us? Why don't they value our opinions? Why don't they recognize our experience? And it's like, it's not that they don't trust you, it's that they want to see it in action. They want to see that you're engaging here, not that you're just coming in and lording it over us based on what you've done somewhere else, because you're not in Kansas anymore. There was a lecturer came to one of the universities in the South Island from the States, and they started off talking about all the different professorships that they'd held and the books that they'd published and the research things they'd been involved in. And one of the students put their hand up and said, why are you telling us all this? And the lecturer was a bit kind of taken aback. You know, they didn't immediately respond. So the student followed up and said, because if you're trying to tell us what a good lecturer you are, just get on with it and we'll decide. And she was really quite offended. You know, what do you mean you'll decide? You know, I'm established. I'm proven. I'm recognized. You know, who do you think you are exactly? But the way these things play out in different places, you have to take account for if you're not going to be disorientated and confused. But the primary thing is always to have an understanding that the gospel and God's revelation will challenge every culture in every place at every time, because God has come in from outside. God isn't Scottish or Kiwi or, you know, perish the thought, even Canadian. You know, that God is the God of the whole earth and of all people everywhere. So, you know, when you think about leadership, for example, when Jesus talks about leadership to the disciples and he says, the kings and rulers of the Gentiles lord it over you and declare holidays in their honor, but you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest must be like the least. You know, whoever would be great must become like a child. You know, I am among you as one who serves. What Jesus is saying there is that the model of leadership that you are seeing isn't my model of leadership. It's not about power and control and telling people how great you are and doing things for your own benefit. It's about serving people. And that is a countercultural message, because it, at the heart, it challenges our sinful human selves. And that kind of challenge, although it will work out slightly differently where you are, the primary kind of challenge to think about things differently because of who Jesus is and what God has said in his word is where that actually is driven from, rather than us just evaluating the strengths and weaknesses of different cultural mindsets, frameworks, or traditions.
Have you had experiences yourself of trying to import like a Scottish way of doing something or a New Zealand-ish, a Kiwi-ish way of doing something that hasn't worked here or that you've had to account for or adjust?
One of the questions I kept getting asked in the first kind of few months I was here was, when are you going to tell us what to do? When are you going to tell us what the new vision is and what the big plan is? And
wait, that only happened the first few months and not ongoing every single month?
Well, there was definitely an expectation that I was going to have some big pronouncement to make. And I I kind of said probably never is the answer to that question because I am, I believe much more in trying to work things through collaboratively in teams and in community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the things that I've seen work best over time come through grassroots initiative. You know, it's easy in leadership to think, I've got this blueprint. You know, I'm going to restructure, I'm going to rebrand, I'm going to redevelop, I'm going to re-energize. And the kind of these great schemes, they often look better when you're dreaming them up in your head than when you try to put them into practice on the ground. So I'm sure I have made mistakes in the way that I've spoken about things and done things, but I've really tried not to bring in something from outside. I've been trying to listen to what's here, to try and, you know, I think one of the primary tasks of leadership is to try to find the grace of God in the situation that you go into and work out how you partner with that. Because ultimately, it's God's work that he calls us to be involved in. And, you know, that changes the way that you think about these things quite significantly.
I'm torn between two questions. On the one hand, I kind of want to ask, like, well, what did you see? Like, where did you see the grace of God as you observed in this movement? And then I think the other question that I want to ask has more to do with, like, how you were welcomed into Canada.
I think the grace of God is primarily seen in the lives of people, that there were a lot of good, committed staff, supporters, students who had a clear vision for InterVarsity and wanted to be part of the next season of what God was going to do. Mm. I think what's the second question?
The second question has to do with, like, how were you welcomed to Canada? So you talked about, like, the first few months, this recurring question of when are you going to make a big pronouncement? But were there other pieces to sort of the welcome that you received, or maybe if I can use the word hospitality, that you received upon arriving in Canada and since, that has maybe felt distinctly Canadian, or alternatively that hasn't?
One of the things that I have learned on the way through life is that when people ask you, how do you find our country? The best thing to say is, it's a very nice country and the people are very friendly. And everyone is happy with that, yeah, with that answer. So my experience of Canada is, it's a very nice country, people are very friendly.
Good answer.
I think it would be fair to say that we had a leadership team in place that had been together for a long time. And when you get change in leadership after periods of stability, there is always more turbulence because it upsets the way things have been. And there's always people who feel more positive about that and people who feel more negative about that. And navigating those kinds of waters in any leadership transition is hard for everybody. But, you know, I very much appreciated the encouragement and the support of a lot of people on the staff team and on the board.
Okay, Nigel, this podcast is called Sanjana Needs a Friend. But I'm curious, do you feel like you and Ailsa have made friends since moving to Canada?
Well, that's a good question because we kind of felt we were starting to make some progress when COVID hit.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last year, we have not really seen anybody because being in a new country, we don't really have anybody in our bubble.
Right.
You know, our parents are all in Scotland. Two of our kids are in New Zealand. The middle one is in London in the UK. We have not seen any of them for, in some cases, coming up for 2 years, in some cases over a year. And the same with our older friends in Scotland and New Zealand. We certainly developed some friendships in InterVarsity, but you know, we haven't really, the first year we were here, we traveled a lot because we thought it was important to try and visit all the different provinces and all the different camps and get a sense of what was going on the ground rather than just being in Toronto. In fact, we just finished that last leg of that with you in Newfoundland,
mm-hmm.
the week before lockdown kicked in, basically, when COVID was just beginning to raise its head. Yeah. So we managed to visit every province in that kind of first year and a bit. But having been here for the last year and a bit now, it hasn't really given us the opportunity of getting to know people or getting mm-hmm. to know some things in the city a whole lot better because the people have been in bubbles and the things have been closed. So, you know, we haven't left Ontario for over a year, and we haven't been on a plane for over a year. So I think it's been a pretty strange year for everybody, but it's certainly not been an easy year for building friendships. We're moving house next Tuesday. So we packed up our visitor book in the condo the other day, and the last entry in our visitor book is November 2019. So we didn't have a single person in our house in 2020. And that was a bit of a shocking revelation to us, really, because we've spent most of the time just in our own little bubble, effectively.
So when this podcast wraps up, we can start the Nigel Needs a Friend podcast.
Well, there was a character called Nigel Nomates that was in popular culture for a while, and I don't feel like Nigel Nomates. You know, I feel I have got a good group of friends around the world and even in Canada. But I think the lack of face to face and human interaction with people does get to you after a while.
Mm-hmm.
I made a little kind of slideshow for my birthday, kind of thinking back on significant relationships and memories, and that was kind of slightly therapeutic for me, just thinking about some of the people that I've known for a long time who've had a positive influence in my life. But it also just reminded me of the absence of those people and the loss of that in this season. There's definitely been encouragements over this past year, and I think it's helped us to think about things differently. But I think there's also been huge loss, and I think we're kind of collectively mourning a lot of what has been lost.
Yeah, you've certainly got a lot of connections globally. And I've been interested to sort of see how it feels like as a Canadian movement, we're moving towards being more connected to our global brothers and sisters, as opposed to like just focusing on our connection with the American movement, which of course is important to us. They're right next door. We helped plant that movement, but the one thing we can lord over the Americans forever. but yeah, I think like seeing opportunities for our global relationships to grow has been interesting. I wonder if you just have anything to say about like that progression.
Canada has been involved with the growth of the international fellowship from day one.
Mm.
You know, as you say, there was planting in the US, but Howard Guinness, who came to Canada, also went to Australia and New Zealand and helped pioneer work there. Kathy Nicholl went to pioneer work in Jamaica, first in high schools and then in universities. Stacey Woods became the first general secretary of IFES, having been the general secretary president of the Canadian movement. And InterVarsity Canada was one of the 10 founding movements of the International Fellowship after the Second World War. So it's those kind of international connections have very much been part of our DNA as a movement. So at that point, I don't think we're doing anything particularly radical or different. One of the things I do within IFES is I head up the Breaking New Ground initiative, which is the global pioneering network. And we held one of the network gatherings of the younger pioneers in Canada at Pioneer Ontario. And we had an event in the National Service Centre. We invited some supporters to come and meet some of those folk that were here. And we've got one of the kind of younger pioneers coming to our all staff conference call tomorrow, who we're going to be developing a more kind of formal partner relationship with in her work in Africa. So I think there's a huge amount of potential for us to build and develop. And I think where people make face-to-face connections, it makes a big difference. I think probably the World Assembly being in Canada was something that gave a bit of a kind of shot in the arm to the international relationships back then. But it's one of these things that you have to keep on top of. In New Zealand, the movement there for 20 years has funded theological scholarships for staff with UESI to study in India. Because if you can get your theological education where you are, it doesn't come with the same baggage as going somewhere overseas to study, and it also comes at far less cost.
Mm-hmm.
So students raised funds for years to pay for scholarships for two or three staff in India. But it got to the point where people were getting fed up with it. You know, it's like, what's the point of this? Because there was too big a distance between what they were doing and the relationship. So we invited somebody to come from India, and they came to our national student conference and visited one or two of the groups and spoke about it. And it made a complete transformation to the way that the students thought about it, because they had a face and real life stories and first-hand experiences to relate to. And you know, you don't learn world vision because somebody tells you that you should. You learn it through interacting with people in different places and praying for people in different places and visiting people in different places. And you know, I hope that we'll be able to have, you know, more global projects, more teams coming to Canada and going from Canada. And I hope we'll be able to have more definite relationships with people who who we pray for and hear from and encounter on a regular basis.
Yeah, that definitely has not been something that's been doable over the last year and a bit. As a campus minister, I feel like and also as someone whose mother was a UESI staff worker, I feel like I have certain expectations or like a certain understanding of what it looks like to be partnered with our global movements. But I wonder like what you think that growing partnership or that re-partnership looks like in a camp setting or a high school setting where maybe it's harder to take kids on missions trips, right? But having that exposure, that firsthand exposure that you're talking about to like start valuing global vision, it is also really important.
Yeah, the camps that I was involved with in Scotland were run by Scripture Union. And Scripture Union in Scotland decided that part of the camping program would be to have an international project that was featured usually for 3 years. And there would be multimedia material about it produced. There would be activities that happened at camp that raised money for that. So I remember we raised funds and built a camp in the Ukraine. And another project that we had was a partnership with Union Biblica in Peru, where we raised funds to buy a building there to work with street children in Lima. And I think part of the benefit of that is it taps into something that young people are actually quite interested in. You know, the sense of being part of a global world and of being more, you know, this generation is perhaps the most connected generation there's ever been. You know, there is a concern about justice, about the environment, about what's happening in the world, about how things happening one place affect what's happening somewhere else. And us helping people to see that through a lens of faith and to appreciate what is happening in the church in these places. What are Christians facing in terms of persecution or opportunity? How are they responding to different challenges? What's it like being a teenager who was a Christian in this place or that place or under a totalitarian regime or in a more kind of secular context or where you're very much a minority? So I think it's actually a really significant opportunity, because if we limit God to our own situation, we tend to limit God in our own situation. You know, if we bring up kids to believe that God is basically Canadian, then they actually are missing a theological truth that people around the world are made in God's image, and the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And God has a plan for the salvation of the world, that at the end there will be people from every tribe and every nation praising him for eternity. And that we have this commission to take the good news of Jesus to the corners of the earth. And that compelling vision, that heartbeat of God for all peoples in the world, needs to be a fundamental strand in our discipleship. You know, it can't just be something that's for a few keen enthusiasts who somehow develop a special interest in missions. It's absolutely fundamental. It's why global vision is one of our five key aims. And that emphasis on world mission has actually been part of the DNA of InterVarsity from the beginning, and indeed of most IFES movements around the world from the beginning.
That was part one of our two-part finale episode of Sanjana Needs a Friend, featuring Nigel Pollock. thanks for listening, and thanks for listening all the way through this mini series endeavor.
Yeah, we hope that this podcast has helped us feel connected to one another across the country in this season where we often struggle with loneliness and isolation in ministry. We're not doing the type of work we want to really be doing right now, so hopefully some of this podcast will actually be helpful and helping us just be a better fellowship with one another.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I hope you all email Nathan Thompson to talk about the Raptors.
Yep.
And Josh Chu, because maybe you could become one of the J-Chosen.
The J-Chosen. Mm-hmm. Practice your Korean. See you next time. Do 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 do